This is the podcast for Wednesday, February 13th, 2013, Theories of Knowledge. Daughter. So today we're going to review for the exam after we finish talking about Kant a little bit more. The exam's open right after class. You have until, next Wednesday, I think, when the lab's closed, to take it. It will cover Berkeley, Hume, and Kant. There may be some questions involving Locke, so you it's a good idea to review Locke as he relates to Berkeley and Hume. So there might be a question about, like, what Berkeley would say about Locke's primary and secondary qualities, what he thinks about Locke's concept of substance, those sorts of things. What else about Locke? Those are sort of the main things. So there may be questions which ask you to relate concepts in Locke to Berkeley and Hume. But there won't be any questions only on Locke. So focus on Berkeley, Hume, and Kant. Same format, you get a 3x5 card, front and back. If you want to help reviewing, come by office hours or make an appointment. On Monday we start with belief and will. Monday is a holiday, right? So no class on Monday. We get two Monday. It's President's Day. So we get two Monday holidays. We get the Martin Luther King Day and President's Day. So no class Monday. On Wednesday, we'll be talking about belief and will. And that's W.K. Clifford, William James, and Soren Kierkegaard. I don't know if we'll get to all three on Wednesday, but that's what's on the slate. I think probably the belief and will stuff might dovetail to next week just because of the holidays, or, cuts our class week in half. So I don't know if we'll get to everything in the belief and will chapter on Wednesday. Okey-doke. I actually gave you till the following Thursday to take the exam because of that holiday. So you'll have from after class today until Thursday of next week to take the exam. The lab and the entire campus will be closed on Monday. So don't think you can be coming up here and using the lab or going to the library or something. Public safety will chase you around and kick you out or whatever. Ask you a bunch of questions. Yeah.
Is it required to be here today?
Is it required to be here today? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Required in what sense?
Is it ever required? You said it was a review day.
I didn't say it. Not entirely. So we're going to talk about Kant some more and then do a little bit of review. So, it's not required to be here any day because I just don't take attendance except for the first week. But hopefully we help you with some things in class here that will help you do better on the exams. All right. I hope everyone's finding the classes they want to register for in case you didn't notice. Got registration started on Monday for those like me who have over 60 credits. I'm like, 111. I'm doing pretty good. So I think now it's down to like everybody or 30 credits or something like that. They do the staggered registration. Thursday's everybody. So, get in there early because all my classes are filled already except for the Contemporary Moral Issues class. So if you're looking for a class, I'm doing Contemporary Moral Issues. That's going to be more of a practical class. And If this stuff kind of leaves you cold because it's very abstract and theoretical, Contemporary Moral Issues will give you a sort of another side of philosophy that's very brass tacks, very practical. It's all about social and political issues, about everyday morality, and I hope to have some guests in class this term. And it's a cable television thing, so you can sit home. You wouldn't have to come to class. You could just sit home and watch TV. And if you don't have cable, you can catch it on the YouTube. We post YouTube links. And also there's a live stream if you happen to be free at that time. It's Tuesday, Thursday from 1 to 3. We do a live stream on the internet too. So it's Philosophy 205. And that's a good way to get that pesky multicultural diversity requirement, whatever they're calling it these days. It fulfills that requirement. Cultural diversity. Cultural literacy, right? Oh, what? Yeah, as if like being PC is sort of like being able to read and write. But yeah, it fulfills that requirement. So if you don't want to take, you know, Victim Studies 101 or whatever, you can take Philosophy 205 and get that credit out of the way. Okay. Oh, and also, if you're interested in doing, like, occasionally I'll do independent study philosophy, or I'm looking for someone to do a co-op through Poli-Sci, or Students for Liberty Club's been languishing. I've been busy. A bunch of the students graduated. A couple more got jobs, and so our fledgling club sort of fizzled. So there have been a couple of people who are interested, but they're not willing to spearhead the effort. So if you're interested in earning 3 credits in political science, you want to get some experience under your belt organizing people and organizing events, maybe bring some high-profile speakers onto campus. There's a couple of people talking to me that like might have some money for speakers, and a couple of organizations we're partnering with. So if you're interested in being part of that, just talk to me and get 3 credits of political science through cooperative education. And it's a commitment of about, they say 10 hours a week. I don't know if I'd exactly hold that to you. And that counts like going to club meetings and things like that. And so anyway, if you're interested, let me know. It's the Students for Liberty Club coordinator, organizer. And hey, you could even put president on your resume. It might look good when you're applying to college or something. All right. Kant. So last time we talked about noumena and phenomena. There'll be a lot of definitions on what happened there. Definitions on the test. Oh, this is the pen that was here. This is what happens when you have a professor who's, you know, punctuating a point like this, I guess, or you know, I don't know, too much stress. They forgot to take their medication.
Maybe that's where the pens mixed up.
Okay, there we go. So, on the exam, there will be lots of terms, and you know, some of these Kant terms is sort of hard to hang them on anything. So, there'll be noumena, phenomena, what else do we have with Kant? A priori, a posteriori, analytic, and synthetic. Synthetic. So what's an analytic statement?
An analytic statement where the predicate is definitely in the subject.
Good. And make sure, like, I might have a joke, like, not a joke answer, but a kind of tricky answer, where I might say the predicate, the subject's contained in the predicate, right? So I reverse them. So you gotta make sure.
What's the trick?
The trick would be if I said the subject's contained in the predicate.
But it's really the predicate.
The predicate's contained in the subject, right? So it's the actual way is the predicate is contained in the subject. So, a bachelor is an unmarried man.
And synthetic, the predicate is not something? Yes.
Right. So this is, would be analytic or synthetic?
It's analytic.
Analytic. How about, how about that? Coming up on Valentine's Day. Analytic or synthetic?
Synthetic.
Why is it synthetic?
Because it's
because
not.
The predicate is not contained within the subject.
Yeah, because you
just
can think.
Just like we know what a bachelor is, we don't know if they are happy, more happier than married men, even though we know the definition of a bachelor and a married man.
Exactly. Could have said it better myself.
Yeah. No,
so, now can you see how you would think, as the both the rationalist and the empiricist thought, that, oh, that I can see how this goes now. If it's analytic, then I just think about how ideas are related to each other. And so I don't use my senses, I think about concepts. If it's synthetic, I got to go out there and do some investigation. I got to take a poll of bachelors or do some observation. If I see some guy, you know, walking behind his wife like this, saying, yes, dear. I think, okay, well, there's one that's not very happy, you know. And look on Valentine's Day, and I see all these couples, and I can see if they seem happy, if they're like holding hands and being all sweet. And I go up, are you guys married? Oh, no, we're not getting married. Or, you know, we just started dating, okay? And I see, like, a married couple, and it's like, honey, do you want to do anything for Valentine's Day? No, I'm just too tired with the kids and my job. Let's just stay home, right? And I'm like, okay, I'm very happy. And so I, like, do, like, a poll. And so I use my senses for this, and I just think about concepts for this. And this is why, if you think about this, it'd be like Hume, but also Locke and Berkeley as well. And Descartes, for that matter. They think that, if it's analytic, it's got to be a priori. And if it's synthetic, it's known a posteriori. And these are two Latin words. I took Greek, not Latin, so I'll give you the exact translation. But it's a priori. A posteriori. The A is like its own word. And this means before you have any sense experience, and these means after. See, like the word posterior, right? Like your posterior. So it's a posteriori means afterwards. A priori, something that's prior. It comes before. And so it's, you know, before experience and after experience. So before you have any experience, you know a bachelor is an unmarried male. It's only after you've had some experiences doing some with your senses, doing some investigation out there in the world, that you realize whether bachelors are happier than married men or not. They die younger. The married men live longer. Or maybe it just seems that way. I'm not sure. Have to do some more investigation.
And Kant believes in synthetic a priori.
Right, Kant says there's a special category in here, but let's just stick with Hume and all the other philosophers before him. They think, okay, analytic a priori, and this is what Hume called relations of ideas. So you think about truths about concepts, relations of ideas. How, you know, the mathematics goes in here, logic, definitions, all anything having to do with concepts or logical thinking, that's all analytic a priori. And then all these philosophers thought, oh, if it's synthetic, then it has to be a posteriori. So it's the matters of fact and existence is what Hume calls them. So anything that has to do with what exists isn't something you can figure out just by thinking about it.
You have to feel it, like senses.
Yeah. So both Berkeley and Hume argue against Descartes, this idea, I think, therefore I am. You can just think about concepts and prove your own existence. Or that you could prove God's existence just by analyzing the concept of God. And Hume says concepts only tell you about other concepts. And if you want to know about what's real in the world, you have to do some investigation. There's one exception in that logic can tell you what can't exist. So a logic can tell you that there's no such thing as a spherical cube. So like if I told you, I'll bet you $20 that I have a spherical cube in my pocket, then you would be right to take me up on that bet, because that's a bet you can't lose. Because I might have a sphere in my pocket, I might have a cube in my pocket, I might have nothing at all in my pocket, but you know for a fact I don't have a spherical cube, because those are contrary concepts. It's a contradictory statement. You can know for a fact that I didn't bake a cake all by myself that Alberto helped me bake, right? Because it may be that I baked it, it may be that Alberto baked it, it may be that we baked it together, but I could have baked it by myself and have him help me. Because if he helped me, then I didn't bake it by myself. So that's, again, a logically contradictory concept. So logic can tell you about what can exist, what can't exist, but it can't tell you what does exist. To do that, you need to use your senses. And that's kind of common sense, and they would say there's nothing in these categories. If it's synthetic, you can't just think about concepts and know it, and know what the facts are. If it's... if you know something independent of the senses, it's not synthetic. And if you know something through the senses, then it can't be analytic. And this one, makes a lot of sense. Here's the area where Kant disagrees. He says, no, there are certain facts about the world that we know a priori. And they're not just these trivial truths, like a triangle has three sides. They're not definitions. It's not just basic logical axioms. But there are certain things which, if they weren't true, we wouldn't be able to have the experiences we have and know the things that we know. And so if we think away Hume and say, now we're talking about Kant, Kant would agree that there's a lot of a priori analytic truths and that there's a lot of a priori synthetic truths. And he would also agree with this, that there's no analytic a posteriori. If it's analytic, it's known through reason. But what about these synthetic truths?
He says that math and
Presuppositions of science.
Yeah, presuppositions of science are actually synthetic because the predicate is not held within the subject. For example, if you have a simple mathematic statement like you said in class last time, 4 = 4 = 7, you can also have 1 + 6 = 7, thus the predicate is not held within the subject.
Right. So math is synthetic, and it's also a priori. And it's sort of kind of a weird thing. Think about let's take the math thing for a second. A triangle has three sides. That's something that's still analytic. Even though it's geometry, it's a definition of a triangle. That's what a triangle is. But what about a triangle interior angles equals, anyone know what they equal? 180 degrees. Kant would say that's not that's not something you can know is true just by thinking about the concept of a triangle. It's a fact about triangles. It's not part of the essence of a triangle. And so that would be synthetic. But it's also a priori, because you don't use your senses to discern it. You go through this deductive process of a geometric proof. You have to go through a bunch of steps to prove it. But it's still synthetic in that the subject's not contained in the predicate's not contained in the subject. There, I got it turned around. So this would be synthetic a priori. So in addition to mathematics being synthetic, Kant has what he calls the presuppositions of science. And the key one of these is every event has a cause. As a cause. So it's synthetic a priori. What would be a way of turning this sentence into something that's not synthetic but is analytic? If you go, there's like just one word we could change in there that would make the sentence every event has a cause from being synthetic to being analytic.
Every cause.
Well, that's close. Every what? Every cause has an effect, right? Or we can just say every effect has a cause, right? Every effect.
And that would make it analytic?
Right. So this is... this is analytic. Now, why would this be analytic? Well, what is an effect?
Something that is affected by something?
Yeah, it's something which is produced by what?
A cause,
right? What's a cause?
Something
that produces an effect. Right? So the two are interrelated terms. And so every effect has a cause is true by definition, because if it didn't have a cause, it wouldn't be an effect. Because an effect is simply that which is produced by a cause. That's different than the notion of an event. An event is just something that happens. It's not just something that by definition has a cause. And if an event happens, you might say, well, maybe there isn't a reason why it happened. Is there a reason why everything happens? And some people would say no. You get some physicists that I listen to say, you know, the universe sort of spontaneously came into existence for no particular reason, and that's why we don't need to worry about God anymore. And then they draw a bunch of equations and try to say that the equations prove their point, and I don't understand the math, so I say, well, pardon me if I'm a little skeptical. But you might think that there might be some things that happen for no reason, and some that have no explanation, even in principle. They're just random events. Or you could say that everything has a cause. There's a reason for everything. And that's not... even though there might be a true answer to one of those alternatives might be true, the other one might be false, you can't know it just by thinking about the concept of an event. The concept of an event is ambiguous as to whether or not it has a cause. And so every event has a cause is... it's a significant truth about the world. It's something, but it's also a priori, because you didn't discover it through sensation. As you know, Hume demonstrated, you can never know that every event has a cause through sensation. All sensation shows you is that's the way it's always happened in the past, and I really strongly feel that it's going to happen that way in the future. Every class, I'm sure I'm going to hear that rumble, right? Rumble, I always wonder what's going on. It's like somebody's rolling a cart or something.
Or something.
Yeah. But every event has a cause is synthetic a priori. It's synthetic because having a cause is a part of the definition of an event. The predicate has a cause is not contained in the subject event. And so it's synthetic, but it's also a priori in that it's not something you can know through the senses. But it's something, Kant would say, it's something that we do know. And that's why he departs from Hume. Hume says, oh, we can't prove cause and effect with empiricist principles, so let's get rid of it. And we can't make any claims to know there's such a thing as cause and effect. Kant says that we do know there is such a thing as cause and effect, that to make sense of anything in our world, we have to assume that it exists. Yeah.
So Hume recognizes that every event has a cause, that statement is synthetic, but disproves, I guess, that statement by saying it can't be verified through the senses due to the lack of the necessity of what was it? The
necessary connection.
Necessary connection.
Right.
But wouldn't necessary connection be referencing cause and effect rather than cause and event? Or does it not matter?
Well, he's talking about, like, Hume saying, okay, here's what people who believe in cause and effect, here's what they mean. And that if one thing causes another, that means if one thing happens, this other thing has to happen. Right? That's the necessary connection. And Hume says, you can't observe necessity, so therefore the necessity isn't there, it doesn't exist. Because to say something's real is to say that you can observe it. You can't observe it, you don't know it's there. And so, so Hume actually doesn't make a distinction between analytic, synthetic, a posteriori, a priori. Part of the problem is that these philosophers, they kind of tend to conflate these concepts. So to conflate something is to like treat something as being the same thing. It's like actually an important concept in philosophy. Conflation. Is confusing to concepts. And that's what the empiricists conflated analytic and a priori. And also synthetic and a posteriori synthetic. Just like you might say, like, this is the one thing I've noticed. I talk to people that tell me they're a liberal, and they say, oh, if you're a conservative, if you're a libertarian, or if you're not a liberal, that you're a greedy, selfish bastard, and you're just out for you and yours. And their idea is that if you don't want to like give all your money to the government, that somehow you're a selfish person. And they're assuming that the only way anybody ever got help was from the government. Then they're totally ignoring the idea of voluntary charity. They're ignoring the help that you give people when you give that person a job through private enterprise. And so there are all sorts of ways to help people that have nothing to do with government. The same thing with charity. They think, oh, you're selfish if you're not for higher taxes. Well, maybe you want to help people in your own way. Maybe you want to give money out of your own pocket in ways that you think will help people. And maybe you think giving your money to the government is a really bad way to try to make society a better place. And so that's a good example of conflation. And you might say conservatives conflate religion and morality. Just to be fair to the other side, right? That people think, oh, if you're a religious person, that means you're a moral person. And if a person doesn't believe in God, that means they have no ethics and so on. And there's many people that have high moral principles that have no particular belief in God. And there's many people that have a belief in God who are very immoral. Like you look at the in the majority of people in prison. I don't know if this is before they got into prison or after they got there, they got religion. But a lot of people who are convicted of criminal offenses have some belief in religion. And yet they did all these horrible things to their fellow man. Although, I mean, sometimes they just did some bad things themselves, and they're in prison for a victimless crime like drugs or prostitution or something like that. But you get a lot of people that commit property crimes, murders, assaults, and they have no doubt that there's a higher being that's going to judge them someday. That seems irrational to me that you go out and do things because it seems like you would piss off an omnipotent being, and that if that being is a just being, that he's going to punish you, and there's no way you can sort of get away with it. Whereas if you're an atheist, you think, oh, well, as long as I don't get caught, I'm good. So it seems it's kind of strange to me, but it's the case. So you don't want to conflate those two concepts either. So coming back to analytic synthetic, a posteriori, a priori, the empiricists tend to think, oh, analytic and a priori, they think about them sort of being the same thing. Oh, relations of ideas, that's all about ideas and concepts. It doesn't have anything to do with what exists. Oh, you're talking about synthetic. Oh, you're talking about like what exists. That means you got to use your senses. And that's the stuff you find out through sensation. And they don't really make this distinction, which Kant sort of brings out for the first time, that you actually can break these into different categories, that analytic doesn't mean the same thing as a priori, and synthetic doesn't mean the same thing as a posteriori, and there are these different combinations. Comments or questions?
Kant's not an empiricist.
Right. Okay. Kant has a synthesis between rationalism and empiricism. So on the exam, look for this word synthesis. A synthesis is when you bring together the elements of two things.
Synthesis?
Yeah. Of rationalism and empiricism.
Okay. And I guess I was looking for the definition of phenomena.
Uh-huh. So, phenomena is the world that's humanly experienced. Use the phrase the world as such. As German, I don't know if it translates well. As opposed to phenomena, which is the world in itself, or the thing in itself. Oops, sorry. Phenomena is the world as humanly experienced, or
phenomena is the world in itself.
No, sorry. Numina is the world in itself, a thing in itself. Did I write this reversed the last time or something?
No.
Okay. So numina is the world as it exists, apart from all human perception and conception, the way things are.
Looks like reality versus appearance.
Right. It's the reality of the world. Phenomena is the way the world appears to us through our human senses and through the way our mind puts together all those senses to form a picture of the world. And Kant's key insight is the way our mind puts together the data from the senses to form a picture of the world actually helps create that world. It adds to the content of our experience. So it's not as if our senses are giving us data for the objective world and creating a picture that's a copy of things out there and the two sort of match up. It's that the world out there is unknowable. Somehow we're in touch with it through our sensations. Our mind creates a picture, but the picture doesn't match up with the world. The picture is sort of a grid we put on top of the world to help us get through life. It's sort of it's a way we interpret the world. So the world, raw experience, really can't do anything with. But the way your mind creates your experience through organizing data from the senses in a particular way, and that is actually what creates your experience. And so it's not just things like color or smells and tastes that are being created by you, but it's all being created by you. The way, again, last time we were talking about thinking about the world in terms of substance and property, thinking about things in terms of quantity, the concept that even of a material object, all those things are created by our minds, the way we think about space and time. Now, there's something in the world out there like all those things, which allow us to experience the world as we do, but we can never know the world directly. And so I know this is kind of this is probably one of the more difficult things to wrap your mind around. But if you think about Locke's secondary qualities, right? Think about color. So, is the object out there in the world really colored? Is that brick wall really red? And Locke says it's not really red. What happens is it really has a property of having a kind of surface structure. And it's really made of molecules. Those molecules really reflect a wavelength of light into your eyes at a certain measurable wavelength. But then your eye creates this sensation of redness. That's you doing something with that wavelength. It's a secondary quality. It's the way the bricks are affecting you. The bricks would affect an alien without color perception or without the same color perception differently. And it might affect the bat differently. And so part of the reason why you see that as red is you have cones in your eyes which interpret that sensation as red. Now think about all of your sensations like that. It's all secondary qualities. Everything's like color perception. That your mind's not just creating that, but the whole concept of an object and the concept of things existing in space and time, all those things are being created by your mind in reaction to what's out there in the world. And so Locke wants to say primary qualities like shape and size are, it's sort of what you see is what you get. And Kant says, no, it's none of what you see is what you get. Everything you perceive and everything you think about is from the human perspective. It's created by your consciousness. And you're not really directly aware of anything in the world. All you're aware of is the picture of the world that you've created in your mind. And because we share a common human nature, we get a similar picture. And so Kant says to do science, let's just focus on that picture of the world we have in our minds and not worry about trying to get to reality because we can never do it. Yeah?
Does that mean we can never experience phenomena? We can only experience phenomena because we are experiencing it through our senses.
Correct. Noumena is unexperienceable. You can never experience movement by definition. And it's sort of, and you think about Locke's concept of substance, right? That's something I know that what which supports qualities. That's kind of what the Newman is like. It's something you can't, you can only not, you know, experience it through the senses. You can't even conceive of what it's like because you're stuck in your human way of thinking. Noumena is that which is beyond human thought. It's the world as it is in itself. Yeah.
So this notion Kant has of a unitary consciousness, mm-hmm. or like a self or soul, basically, is that kind of leaning toward innate anything, like innate ideas or something? Because he argues that the bundle of perceptions that Hume believes in, it can't be learned through experience, but rather we do kind of know that we have a self.
Mm-hmm.
So does he kind of believe in innate ideas?
Yeah, he believes in innate capacity. So Kant on the self. So he thinks we have certain innate capacities for learning, and if we didn't have those, we couldn't learn. Kant always argues in the following way. He says, okay, here's how things are in our experience. What would have to be true for those things to be in our experience? So we learn things. What would have to be true for us to learn things? Well, in order to learn things, you have to have all these different faculties working together. You have to have memory, and you have to have experience, and you have to have a new experience and relate it to the old experience. So there has to be something that's doing the relating of the memory to the old experience and then comparing it with the new experience and making a judgment. So what is it that's making the judgment based on past experience and new data? And that has to be some kind of a subject or a unitary consciousness, a self or a soul. And he would say it doesn't make sense to think about just sort of bundles of disjointed ideas coming and going, doing learning. You need a thinking subject to do that, or what he calls a unitary consciousness. And so that's his argument against Hume for the self, that in our experience, we learn things. We wouldn't be able to learn things unless we were us, unless we had a unitary self that was more than just a jumble of ideas or disjointed experiences or just experiences connected in some mysterious way. There has to actually be a thinking subject and structures present in the mind which make learning possible. Any thoughts on that? Questions? Does that make sense? Is it, maybe all this concepts are sort of heady. I think if I could say it another way. Q thinks about the mind as sort of a placeholder for the fact that I can't experience your thoughts and you can't experience mine. And Hume says, just peer into your mind for a minute and see what's there. And he says, the only thing you ever find there is a feeling or a sensation or a thought or a memory. And these are all just sort of discrete states of consciousness. And they're related in certain ways. Like, I think about, if I think about, say, a pizza, then I might get a feeling of hunger, right? So those are related. Or as maybe you're lactose intolerant, so you think about pizza and you have some unpleasant sensations resulting, and it makes you feel nauseous, right? So, and if I think about a pizza, it doesn't make you hungry. So there are these interrelations between concepts that are interrelations between what Hume calls ideas. But that's not enough to explain the phenomena of learning and the fact that as human beings we're capable of learning. Because learning involves all these different complex processes. And it can't be explained by ideas just being related in certain ways. The same thing with cause and effect. Hume says, you can't observe cause and effect, get rid of it, because you can't get rid of your claim to know there's such a thing. Kant says, look, we live in a world of cause and effect. Our every action presupposes it. When you, when someone throws a rock at you and you duck, that shows that you believe in cause and effect. Why would you believe in cause and effect? Why do you think in terms of cause and effect? There really must be such a thing. And so if empiricism tells you that you don't know there's such a thing as cause and effect, get rid of empiricism. It's wrong. And so what would have to be true for us to know there's such a thing as cause and effect? Well, essentially, we have to have a kind of intuition that there is such a thing. And Kant would say our experience presupposes there is such a thing. So when you see a cause and you expect its usual effect, that's not just conditioning from past experience. Kant would say you experience the world through cause and effect because there really is such a thing. But you can't prove it through the senses, therefore you must know it through reason, through the mind's logical structures. And so Kant would say that again, science presupposes there is such a thing as cause and effect. And this kind of goes back, you know, more towards rationalism. Remember when I was talking about like the notion of equality, how the empiricist says you start as a blank slate and then you start seeing, you know, having experiences, and as experience writes on your mind, you somehow come up with these concepts. And you start out with like the concept of inequality. So Locke says, you learn like a rod is not a cherry. So the idea is that you look at, you have an experience of like a stick, yeah, a rod, and then you have an experience of a cherry, and then you notice, oh, this is round, and this is long and thin, and you say, okay, I can see the difference between those two things. But how would you even notice a difference, you know, without some category in your mind, some concept of differentiation, or the concept of an object? So there has to be something there in your mind that allows you to even distinguish one object from another, to notice that these two objects have different properties, that this one is red and this is brown. Right? You can't distinguish them if you're just getting just bare, raw data from the senses. You just get a cacophony of colors and shapes. It's your mind that has to sort of put them together. So there has to be, and then like suppose even simpler, like you're looking at, two sticks, and you see, oh, this one's taller than this one, or this one's fatter than this one. That already shows that you have some notion of equality and inequality, of larger and smaller in your mind. And Kant says that you start out with these sort of basic logical structures, that the mind starts out with positive content. And this goes along with modern psychology, this idea that we have innate structures in our brain that allow us to perform logical thinking, that allow us to learn from experience, that allow us to learn language. Going back to Noam Chomsky, it's a question a lot of people missed on the exam, by the way. Noam Chomsky was a linguist. He's still around. He's actually at the U of O last year. I went to go see him, and then I saw the line and said, eh. I've seen him on the YouTube. I'd just be there to heckle anyway. So I'd heckle quietly to myself. Cause a stir. I stopped at Cafe Yum with a student. We were both going to go over there together, and then we like spent too long there, and went over there, and when we saw this line, it was like so long, and so that I think another friend of ours was in like the overflow. And, you know, as Chomsky wasn't talking about linguistics, which is all the cool stuff he did. He's talking about his crazy political views. So when Chomsky was doing his work as a linguist, though, and that was what he was known for, he did this groundbreaking work where he showed that there have to be innate structures in the brain which allow human beings to just pick up language. That when you have a kid and he's around people talking, he just picks it up and he starts forming sentences spontaneously. And he doesn't always get it right, you know, the first time, but he'll just start, you know, sort of babbling for a while, and he'll just start talking. And it's not as if you have to teach him the structures of grammar, and you have to teach him, you know, different objects, you know, this is the ball, say ball, Johnny, you know, ball, you know. You can just have that kid sit in the corner and just have people talk around him, and pretty soon he'll pick up the language. Yeah.
I read a lot of Steven Pinker. Mm-hmm. You've heard of him. He's a linguist also. And one of his books he was referencing is studies that he would do where they would just give a kid a word, a nonsensical word like whoa. Uh-huh. And they would give them sentences, and then they'd never heard this word before, and then they would have them translate the sentence to another conjugation. So they would say, here's the word wug. The wug went to the school. What did the wug do? The man will wug tomorrow. What will the man do tomorrow? And they would just say, he will wug. They won't say, he wugs tomorrow. They immediately come up with the grammar rule conjugation
uh-huh.
without ever hearing the word before.
Interesting.
Just hearing it in context.
Yeah, so another more proof of innate structures in the human brain. Kahn, I think, is more psychologically real. And again, he has a sort of the synthesis.
So what's rationalist about Kahn and what's empiricist?
So what's rationalist about him? Innate structures in the mind, kind of like innate ideas. Now, Kant won't say, that your minds are populated with full-blown ideas, but it's got innate capacities to form ideas, to think logically, to understand the world in certain terms, to think in terms of cause and effect, to understand the world in terms of space and time, to understand like perspective and three-dimensional objects. To use language. Kahn didn't know about the language thing, but he would say that your perception, and even the notion of like perspective, to be able to see things in perspective, to know that a small object in your field of vision is a large object at a distance, that whole thing is something that's inborn. It's not something that you learn from experience. Cause and effect. You hear a noise, and then you notice, like, you hear bark, 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 and then you notice that you look over the dog, and the dog's mouth's going like this, right? And it's coming from the dog's direction, and you say, oh, the dog, even if you're a really small child and don't know how to speak, you'd say, oh, that big furry animal's making that scary noise. You'd do that automatically without having to have a whole bunch of experiences. So that's innate. So innate capacities to learn, to think about the world in terms of cause and effect, space and time, to see objects at a distance and to understand what that means. And then what's empiricist about him? Well, he agrees that you can't learn about the world through just thinking about concepts. So you can think about God all day long. You can't prove he exists just by talking about the concept of God. You can't do philosophy as a series of a priori deductions just by thinking about how ideas relate to other ideas. I think, therefore I am. God is a perfect being. A perfect being must contain all perfections. Therefore, God, the perfect being must exist. God exists. God is a perfect being. A perfect being can have no flaws. What is the concept of evil? Evil is a lack. If a being lacks something, it's not perfect. Therefore, God cannot be evil. God must be good. If God is good, he can be no deceiver. Therefore, I can trust my senses. Like that sort of way Descartes wants to do philosophy, like a geometric theorem. And Kant would say, you can't do that. That generally you should use your senses to understand the world, but you have to start out with some a priori concepts first. So you start out with these basic concepts like every event has a cause, like there's an objective world apart from my mind, I have a mind, and then after you have those basic axioms, then you can use your senses to discover significant truths about the world.
So can I just repeat it to you?
Sure.
Understand it? So basically, Kant believes that you do need your senses. He believes that you can't just learn about the world through a priori reasoning, and he believes that you use your senses to understand the world, but you use your senses to understand the world while using your already obtained innate capacities, which you have from birth.
Right.
Okay.
Good.
Got it.
Any other questions about Kant? So maybe we might go over a few questions about Berkeley and Hume.
Yeah.
There are questions. I don't have a lot of questions. for review in the text. I think we hit most of the high points.
Oh, what part of lock is going to be on?
Just like, you have to understand like what a secondary quality is.
That's all.
You have to understand Locke in the following sense. In the two dialogues between Hylas and Philonous, Hylas is Locke. And so when Locke, through Hylas, is arguing with Barclay, who's Philonous, you have to understand the Hylas view. So anything that Hylas says is fair game on the exam. And Hylas is essentially Locke, so in that respect, you need to understand Locke. And it's really hard to understand Barclay without understanding Locke first. But I won't have any question, Locke believed X. But I might say, what would Barclay say about Locke's concept of secondary qualities? So what would you think, what would he say about them? Would you say he would generally agree with the distinction between primary and secondary qualities, but he might have some quibbles about the details? Would you say that he would be in complete agreement? Would you say he would strongly disagree with the concept and say that it was a false distinction? Or what would he say?
He would say that there's no need to make a distinction between primary and secondary qualities.
Yeah, there's no distinction at all between them. Now, why is that? Why, in Barclay's view, why can't there be? Why isn't there a difference between primary and secondary qualities?
Because secondary qualities necessitate that we're apart from whatever material world we're existing in, whereas Barclay believes that we are in the world; we're not just experiencing it secondhand.
Yeah, the distinction is supposed to be between what's here in your mind and what's out there in the world. Well, for Barclay, it's all in your mind, right? It's God sending you the ideas. And so there's no distinction between the color in your mind and the shape out there in the world.
Is it Barclay doesn't believe in the world at all? He believes in only ideas, or is that Hume?
That's both Barclay and Hume.
Okay. That was exactly what I was going to say. So Barclay and Hume, only ideas. That matter. What's the deal with matter?
They don't believe in it, right?
What's that?
They don't believe in any matter.
Right. So who doesn't believe? Who believes in material substance? And Locke Barclay.
Locke.
How about Barclay?
Barclay believes in only ideas.
Ideas and also minds.
And minds. And then Hume doesn't believe in the mind. He believes in a bundle of perception.
Right. And so neither Barclay nor Hume believe in matter. So I might ask you, which of the following philosophers are materialists? And you would say just Locke. I might have, Locke, Barclay, and Hume. And I might have an answer that says Barclay and Hume. Kant believes in material substance, too, so for what that's worth. So Barclay, attacks the concept of matter. Hume agrees with Barclay. Again, you can think about Hume as basically Barclay without God and without the mind. All you have as ideas and the association of ideas. And then Kant comes back and has more of a kind of a Lockean type position. And maybe you can think about Kant as sort of a hybrid between Locke and Descartes. Again, this notion of synthesis, of combining the best elements of both. I follow my political analogy again. I've had politics in the brain after the State of the Union address. So conservative, liberal, or progressive. Libertarian. Right? So you think about the conservatives, they're for economic freedom. They want, if you have a business, they don't think a government bureaucrat should tell you how to run it. They think you could be able to pay your employees what you think they're worth. You should be able to hire and fire whoever you want. And you should be able to keep the lion's share of your profits. Maybe the government can skim a little bit off the top to pay for basic infrastructure, law enforcement, and national defense. The liberals or progressives say, oh no, you should like soak the rich and redistribute the money to the poor. But you ought to be able to free to have your gay marriage. You ought to be able to have like social freedom and be able to do what you want. But you don't get to keep your money. You have to give most of that to the state because we have to give free health care to people, and we have to provide everyone a nice retirement, and you have to have your, everybody's have to have their Obama phone and so on. And so you give away all the stuff to poor people. And so the conservative wants you get economic freedom, and the liberal wants to give you personal or social freedom. But the conservatives also say less personal freedom. Whereas the liberals say, you have less or no economic freedom. For the libertarian, it's freedom across the board. So the libertarians believe in free enterprise, but they're also anti-war. So liberals say, hey, you shouldn't spend all this money on a bloated military, and the conservatives say, we need this big, huge bloated military. And so the libertarians, they're economically or fiscally conservative, but socially liberal. So it combines the elements of the conservative and liberal into a kind of a hybrid view. So that's an example of a synthesis. In the same way, you have Kant takes rationalism and empiricism and forms a kind of a hybrid view of Kantianism. And so he takes this idea of not innate ideas but innate capacities from the rationalist, and this idea that you have to have certain first principles in order to do philosophy. But from the empiricist, he takes this idea that you can't do philosophy a priori, that the senses play this really important role, and that science should generally follow an empirical method. You have to investigate with the senses. And then he combines those into a new view. Yeah.
So is it fair to say that because there's a question in the book that says, how do Berkeley and Hume's views cast doubt on the supposed relationship between empiricism and science? So would it be fair to say that Berkeley and Hume don't believe in the material world and thus believe that science is a priori?
Well, Berkeley and Hume are empiricists, and they don't believe in the material world. Science presupposes the material world. That's what they're studying. And so if empiricism leads you to a view that says you can never know there's such a thing as cause and effect, then that doesn't seem to go very well with modern science, right? Because modern science is all about looking for causes. If you're trying to figure out, suppose you get some kind of you have some kind of study, and you're trying to figure out whether...
Does Berkeley believe in cause and effect?
Berkeley believes in mental causation. So there's the concept of willing. So there's no material causation because there's no material world. But when you can have intention and volition, and you can will certain things to happen. I want my arm to go up. I will my arm to go up, and my arm goes up. That's cause and effect. I want my arm to go up, and God sends me the ideas that I want. Sometimes God sends me ideas I don't want. And that's his way of getting me to do what he wants, I guess. And that's like that's his sort of the consciousness of God that you had. That's how you know there is a God, is that you can't always get what you want. To quote the philosopher Jagger.
think it's because
so the empiricism and modern science don't seem to go together, because if you follow empiricism to its logical conclusion, you can never know things which are required to do science. That there's a material world, that it operates on a laws of cause and effect. Unless you know those things, you can't even start out your work as a scientist. And so that's why Kant's view seems more in keeping with modern science than empiricism.
Because Kant recognizes that science is about causation, and he says that you need to actually experiment and find the truth through your senses.
Right. That so empiricism can't prove there's a material world and can't prove there's cause and effect. Science presupposes there's a material world and cause and effect. If you're trying to figure out whether cell phones cause brain cancer, for example, right? You're presupposing that you have a brain, that there's radio waves, that holding your cell phone up to your ear might mutate the cells and give you cancer. But you're not sure. How do you just think about, well, okay, when I think about like radiation, that seems kind of dangerous, right? Like people get like radiated at Chernobyl, that was bad. And so I think radiation, dangerous, bad, causes mutation. I heard people get brain cancer, right? So radio waves in the brain, I put them together, I think, oh no, cancer, right? And you don't do science like that, though, right? You have to do a study. You have to, like, look at all the people that use a cell phone. You have to distinguish people that use, like, an earpiece and keep the cell phone away from their head versus people that are going like this. You might want to look at, like, how powerful the cell signal is, like, whether they have, like, the relative power of that versus other kinds of radiation you get, like, from your computer screen or what have you. So you do an empirical investigation to find out whether cell phones cause brain cancer. But before you would even start that, you would already be assuming, I have a brain, there is such thing as a cell phone, it's part of the material world, and that the material world operates in terms of cause and effect. And you can't do that unless you're a Kantian. You can't do that as an empiricist.
So Kant basically believes that we have to do empirical investigations of the material world.
Right. And that's what science is all about. Knock off a little early today, so good luck on the exam. And if you would like to do some reviewing, just come by my office and we can chat. Have a good holiday weekend this coming weekend, and happy Valentine's Day.